Members, I'm going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Election Committee. Because of the weather, we do not yet have a quorum, but I will start with Representative Hilty and Representative Morgan. They're both here. We will hold off on really acting on any motions until we have a quorum. So Representative Hilty, Senate File 1298. Representative Hilty, why don't you make your initial motion, and we'll act on it when we have a quorum. And then Representative Morgan is going to explain his portion of the bill. So Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the motion would be that Senate File 1298 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
All right. Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 1298 is a bill that we was subjected to a lot of scrutiny in the last session. Was in fact on the general register, and I think at the time we had a general agreement about the elements of the bill with Representative Broad and with representatives from the governor's office, but time ran out at the end of the session. We weren't able to act on the bill. We have it back before us. Changes have been made. Negotiations have taken place, and I have with me at the table this morning Beth Fraser from the Office of Secretary of State, who has been involved in making the changes to the bill that are represented in the DE1 amendment, and the sheriff that is the form in which we would like to have the bill considered. If you want to entertain a motion to adopt the amendment now, or do you want to...
Representative Hilty, I think the motion to adopt the amendment would be fine, and then we can act on that motion. We're one away from a quorum. And members, again, this is a Senate file under House Rule 4.2. These bills came back to their committees of origin, so as Representative Hilty said, we've acted on at least the majority of this bill. So is Ms. Fraser going to speak to the bill or to the amendment? If she's speaking to the amendment, why don't we move the amendment, and then we'll have the amendment before us.
Mr. Chair, I think we should just address the amendment. So I would move adoption of the F1298DE1 amendment.
So Representative Hilty moves the amendment, and we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll just work with the amendment. Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Fraser. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's Office. And as Representative Hilty said, this amendment includes many pieces from the bill that was passed by this committee last year. At least 18 sections of the bill have been deleted, so it is a slimmed-down version of that bill. Anything with a fiscal impact has been deleted. And we've been in discussions with the governor's office, and I believe that they don't have immediate concerns about any of the language in this delete everything amendment. So to go through the amendment, to do an overview, Section 1 prohibits groups doing voter registration drives from paying employees on a per-card basis or using a strict quota that seems to give an incentive for bad behavior, and so we want to prohibit that. Section 2 clarifies that the statutory definition of signature applies to voters signing voter registration applications. Section 3 removes the requirement for cross-referencing vouchers and voters in the statewide voter registration system. County auditors have indicated that needing to do this cross-reference in the computer system is very time-consuming, and the information is still available on the voter registration card and the voucher oath, which have to be kept together and which can be accessed if necessary. Section 4 clarifies that those who submit absentee or mail ballots but have them rejected have voted for the purposes of continuing registration, because if you don't vote for 4 years, your registration is marked inactive, and so if your ballot was rejected for that purpose, you would be considered having voted. Section 5 does a few things. It modifies the format of absentee ballot envelopes in two ways. It deletes the requirement that absentee ballot envelopes used by voters who are already registered have a flap to conceal the voter's information. And it eliminates the requirement that pre-registered voters have someone who is registered to vote in Minnesota who can administer oaths or notary public witness at the ballot for blank when they arrive, and that the voter voted without being influenced. The requirement for the flap was put in place in 2006 for all absentee ballot envelopes, even though it's really only needed for non-registered voters and military and overseas voters who are required to include ID information on the envelope. Counties have found it very costly to provide either an additional envelope or a flap. The other piece in this section is the new language on 4.26 and 4.27. It's actually just being moved from 5.25 and 5.26, so the requirement to provide first-class postage is not a new requirement. It's already in current law. It's been moved up because we're creating a Subdivision 3 that specifically talks about the eligibility certificate. Section 6 clarifies that county auditors must make disabled, accessible voting machines available to voters during the in-person absentee voting period for all elections, except township elections, because they are currently exempt from the requirement to provide those machines. So the cross-reference is to their exemption. Section 7 allows any county to use an absentee ballot board through which election judges accept and reject absentee ballots during the 30 days prior to the election, which gives voters a chance to correct mistakes that otherwise might have invalidated their vote. Section 8 goes hand in hand with expanding the use of absentee ballot boards. At the same time, we also want to limit the scope of the possible functions of the board so that they may only accept and reject ballots and may not count the ballots. This is how absentee ballot boards have been used, and we think that the ballot should be counted in the precinct with all of the other ballots. It also removes the requirement that the Secretary of State provide counties with sample replacement ballots and return envelopes for absentee ballots, which are rejected, since the counties use the same ballots and envelopes as they do for the first mailing. Section 9 does three things. It allows candidates for state office to file for office either in the county in which they live or at the Secretary of State's office. It clarifies that affidavits of candidacy must be submitted by mail or by hand, but allows that candidates who will be absent from the state during the filing period to submit their affidavits of candidacy to the Secretary of State during the filing period by fax or by sending in a scanned image of their filing as an attachment to an email. The understanding of the law up until 2006 was that the filing for candidacy had to be either submitted by mail or in person. And there was a new interpretation in 2006 allowing for the filings to be submitted by fax, which caused some confusion, and we want to allow that in cases like the case in which it was used, where the person's son was lost in the mountains and he had to go look for his son. You know, we want to still allow him to file, but don't want to have lots of candidates faxing in their filings and having 87 counties having to deal with that. So if somebody has to fax in a filing, we want it to come into our office, and then we will forward it to the county. This section also requires writing candidates for county offices who want their vote counted to file a written request with the filing officer, which is true for federal and state offices. It also changes the deadline for filing this request for all offices to a week before instead of the Thursday before the election. Section 10 allows polling places within the metro area to be up to 1 mile outside of a precinct boundaries instead of 3,000 feet outside of the boundaries. Section 11 allows jurisdictions using vote-by-mail to send ballots to voters when the absentee balloting period begins 30 days before the election. So that if somebody is going to be out of town during the period after which the ballots are mailed, they don't have to come into the office during that time period between 30 days and 20 days when the ballots are currently mailed out. So it does this by allowing auditors to send out the ballots 30 days before the election, and then for anyone who's registered before the 20-day cutoff to send a subsequent mailing to those voters. It also allows jurisdictions using vote-by-mail to have election judges mark the ballots as accepted or rejected at some point during the 30 days before the election, and to send a replacement ballot to any voter whose ballot was rejected at least 5 days before the election. Section 12 states that individuals who are not voting and are not otherwise authorized to be in the polling place must be at least 100 feet from the building. This will give election judges the authority they need to move folks from interest groups like MoveOn.org or others away from the polling place. Currently, anyone who is not electioneering may be 100 feet from the door to the room in which the voting is taking place. As it says here, or as I said, it will give election judges the authority they need to move folks. If a polling place is in a school building and there are children on the playground within 100 feet, I mean, they're going to use their common sense and not force the children to go to the slide instead of the swing set because of the distance. But it will give them the authority they need to move people who need to be moved. Section 13 requires challengers who under current statute already have to be residents of Minnesota to prove that they are residents using any of the documents used for same-day registration. Sections 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18 all go together and allow special elections to be canceled if the county auditor and the commissioner of education, in the case of a school referendum, is notified at least 46 days before the election, which is when a county would begin to do work on the election. Section 19 clarifies that the county auditor is the post-election review official unless they designate a municipal clerk. There was some, it wasn't clear in the current statute who was the post-election review official. Section 20 clarifies ambiguity in the triggers for further post-election reviews, bringing them into line with the standards that were used in 2006, except that in the smallest precincts with 200 or fewer voters, it clarifies that you need at least two votes that were off to trigger an additional review instead of just one. Section 21 requires that campaign finance reports filed by candidates for local office and by committees on local ballot questions include an individual's phone number, signature, and email address, if available. It raises the threshold for the requirement to itemize donations to those of more than $100, which is the same as the threshold at the state level. It also requires the filing officer to withhold the name and address of any individual who contributed more than $100 to a local candidate if the individual signs a statement that this is required for their or their family's safety, which provides the same protection for contributors to local candidates that is provided for contributions to state-level candidates. In terms of the effective date for this section, it's retroactive to January 1, 2008 for contributions. So if somebody made a contribution in February, for example, on the report filed in August, the candidate wouldn't have to differentiate, well, you gave a contribution in February, so I have to itemize this, and you gave your contribution in May, so I don't have to itemize this. But it clarifies that if somebody is a new candidate and has filed their first report, that they don't have to amend their report because of these new requirements. Section 22 states that it is a misdemeanor for a local candidate or committee to fail to file a certification that they have either filed all of their campaign finance reports or not received or spent more than $750. It's currently a misdemeanor for the officer to provide the candidate with the election certificate if the candidate hasn't filed the required certification. So this is just kind of making things equal. Section 23 is the repealer, and it's repealing two sections, 203B02 sub 1A, eliminate experimental procedures used in 1991 and 1992, 203B.13 sub 3A, eliminates language that required county auditors to send lists from an absentee ballot board to the precinct of those who have voted absentee. This is no longer needed because the absentee ballot boards will no longer be authorized to count the ballots and have to send the ballots themselves to the precinct to be counted. So those are the changes in the first article and that relate to Senate File 1298.
All right. Members, we have a quorum. So what we'll do is we'll act on Representative Hilty's motion to get the bill in order. And the motion was to adopt, and there may be some confusion, is it the DE1 amendment or the A2 amendment?
Representative Hilty. Chair, it would be the DE1 amendment.
All right, so
I do have an amendment.
I realize that. Let's get this amendment, let's get the bill in order first. So Representative Hilty moves the DE1 amendment to Senate File 1298. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill now is in the shape that Ms. Frazier had described it. And then you have an amendment to the bill as amended?
I do, Mr. Chair. That would be the A2 amendment to which you referred.
All right.
I believe that has been distributed. And briefly, Mr. Chair and members, what this does is amend some of the provisions that are currently in law regarding the post-election audit. First part of the amendment simply clarifies that that recounts under this section be done manually. They have been, that has been our intent, but we want to make sure that it cannot be interpreted that a recount can be done by simply running ballots back through an electronic tabulator rather than doing that by hand. There are two more substantial parts to the amendment, Mr. Chair. The first, which begins on line 2.25 of the amendment, provides that a losing candidate at his or her discretion can request a partial recount. If the candidate's margin of loss is between 0.5% and 5%, the candidate would be allowed to specify up to 3 precincts to be recounted at the candidate's expense. The language basically is repeated in beginning in line 3.22, but that's because in the first section it refers to federal and state elections, and in the second section it refers to local elections. Mr. Chair, currently the post-election audit provision provides for a recount of randomly selected precincts only in federal and statewide elections for governor. And what this would do is allow a very small partial recount for other candidates if they elected to use this provision. The reason for that, Mr. Chair, members, is that currently every ballot in Minnesota is counted or will be in the next election electronically by either a precinct or a centrally located electronic scanning device.
The discussion to the A2 amendment. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hilty, I was reading something, so if you covered this, please short-circuit it, but I don't understand these partial recounts in this amendment. Why would we ever do a partial recount?
Well,
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the reasoning here is that if there is a malfunction of the electronic scanning device and the programming of the device, it wouldn't necessarily show up in the audits that we are being that we are conducting currently, because it could be specific to a race that was lowered down in the ballot and was not subject to the audit. I think that any candidate would recognize that if they lost badly in a precinct that they expected to win, that there may well be something amiss with the way the ballots were counted. So, if you had the suspicion that something was wrong, for instance, Representative Emmer, if in the next election you ended up getting only 30% of the votes in a precinct that in previous elections you had carried by 70 or 80%, you might think that there was something wrong there. It would give you the opportunity, if you did feel that there had been some malfunction in the counting of the ballot, to ask that maybe only one precinct be recounted. It would be at your expense, but that's not prohibitively expensive. To satisfy the result that indeed the equipment was functioning properly and the result was as had originally been tabulated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, thank you very much. And thank you. I don't agree with the amendment because I think all you're doing is creating more work for lawyers. So in one respect, I thank you for creating more work for lawyers, because it appears to be another jobs bill. On the other side, I just think we already have too many issues. You count one, you count them all. There's too much potential, in my mind, for further problems if you start drilling down to just specific precincts. You either have a contested election or you don't. Because the problem that I see is you have this partial recount, you show some mistakes, then what does that mean? Then we're going to do a recount in another precinct and another one and so on. It actually could increase not only the cost, but the questions as to the integrity of our election. So I would vote against this amendment.
Representative Kahn.
Well, first of all, MasterCard won, the value of a correct election is essentially priceless. And I think that I think this is a very good thing to do in terms of needing to have a whole recount, because that's the kind of election problem that we've seen in some other states, where in a hotly contested congressional, like this happened in Florida, hotly contested congressional election, half the people who walked into it that election decided not to vote for that candidate. So in part of the district or something like that. So, you know, you saw something that looked like an anomaly. And this idea of having the candidates pick it up and pay for it, and then if it's true, you know, getting refunded and going to a full recount seems like a very good way of getting it. It's not a fantasy. It's not something that someone's just thinking about. It's something that has happened around the country. And it shouldn't decide, elections shouldn't be decided that way.
Representative Hilke.
Mr. Chair, I would point out that the post-election audit was conducted as it's currently structured in law after the 2006 election, and I think there were, with one or two very minor exceptions, there were no discrepancies found in any precinct that was subject to the recount anywhere in the state. So really what this provision does, and we're just expanding that to satisfy other people who are involved in contest, what it really does is validate the integrity and reliability of the system. I think it's very important that we have that in place, particularly in light of the questions that have arisen about election systems in other states across the nation. Minnesota is regarded as a leader in this way, and I think that we would do well to maintain our leadership.
Any further discussion? We have not acted on the A2 amendment. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Ms. Frazier or Representative Morgan. Ms. Frazier, did you go over the part of the bill that deals with Representative Morgan? You have not.
No, sir.
All right. Either Representative Morgan or Ms. Frazier, you want to go over that part? I think it's Ms. Frazier.
Yes. So Article 2 represents Senate File 1310, which was our housekeeping bill, which was also passed by this committee last year. The only changes from this bill as it was passed last year are the effective dates. But I'll quickly run through the changes that we're making. Section 1 clarifies that the office title printed on the ballot for soil and water conservation supervisor should reflect the title used in that jurisdiction. Section 2 and many, many other sections in the bill, including Section 3, change the term registration card to registration application. Section 4 removes the requirement that voters doing same-day registration correct their voter registration cards if the name or number of their school district is missing or incorrect, since most voters do not know their school district number. Section 5 says two things. It updates the statutes related to changing the registrations of voters who have moved to reflect the use of the statewide voter registration system, no longer referring to the actual remover of a paper file from the county's records, and brings the statute into conformity with 204B.11 sub 4, which allows patients of... actually, it doesn't do this. I think that's somewhere else in the bill. I'm sorry. Section 6, 7, 8, and 9 all... change card to application. Section 10 is the section that I started speaking about before, which brings this section of statute into conformity with with 204B.11 sub 4, which allows patients of healthcare facilities, participants in residential programs for adults, and residents of battered women shelters to apply for absentee ballots on election day. Section 11 changes card to application. Section 12 modernizes language by deleting a reference to townships using the Australian ballot system, which means secret ballot. Section 13 changes card to application. Section 14 brings a state statute requirement for the process of receiving absentee ballots in line with current practice, allowing them to be initialed and deleting the requirement that they be stamped with an official seal of the office. Section 15 says that applications for absentee ballots do not have to be delivered to the precincts themselves if the absentee ballot envelopes have already been accepted or rejected by an absentee ballot board. The purpose of the applications is to compare the signatures with the signature on the envelope itself, and if that comparison has already been made and the ballot has already been accepted or rejected, there's no need to send an additional stack of paper to the polling place where it won't be used. Section 16 clarifies that for a judicial office and county attorney or for sheriff, that they must provide a copy of their current license. That's the proof that they have to provide that they are licensed. Section 17 codifies the current practice of requiring presidential electors to collect the same number of signatures as other statewide candidates. Section 18 requires that school board candidates' names be rotated on the ballot in the same manner as candidates in state elections. Section 19 clarifies that for the purposes of school board general elections, polling places may not be combined in a way that any polling place has voters voting in more than one board member election district. Section 20 deletes obsolete language referring to an exemption available to cities in 2006. And Section 21 deletes language that inaccurately stated that the Department of Public Safety would need to assemble a database of the last four digits of every Minnesotan Social Security number in order to provide the verification required by the Help America Vote Act. Instead, the Department of Public Safety has entered an agreement with the Social Security Administration to do that verification. This section is retroactive to November 29, 2007, which is when this practice was put into place. I'd be happy to answer any questions about either article.
Any discussion to Senate File 1298 as amended? Representative Thomas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in the, with the loss of Jim Rice, I think I've probably become the, and with the absence of Lynn Carlson on this committee, I've probably become the resident historian. So I'd like to kind of tell people about how the section on filing before the election got into law. Turns out at one time, more than 20 years ago, or about 20 years ago or so, I was spending most of the summer in France with my husband, who was teaching mathematics at a university there, and it was going to cover filing time. And so I had to file. I went to find out... I went to find out how to file. You read the law, there are all kinds of things about using a notary and so forth. And I went to try and find out about how you could use a notary. I went to talk to the person in the Secretary of State's office who was in charge of elections, and he said, why don't you go file at a consulate? And I said, well, there's no consulate in the city we're staying in. The nearest consulate is halfway across France. He said, look, if I have to defend this, I'd much rather be defending something that's written in English and has an American seal on it. So we did spend the day going to Bordeaux to file, and I proceeded to file, and it was fairly stressful because, you know, it covered the 4th of July, and there were all kinds, and so there weren't that many days to get it back by express mail. It all worked. I didn't get unelected because I didn't file, but, you know, we then came up with this idea that people ought to be, if they knew they were going to be away, ought to be able to file in advance. And Linda Scheid, who was the House elections person, you know, carried the bill, put it into law. It got to the Republican caucus, and somebody asked, and Ron Abrams was the person in charge of elections for the Republican caucus. And so somebody asked, why is this provision here? And Ron looked at it and said, oh, that's so that Phyllis can go to France every summer and not have to be around for filing. And so someone probably, I don't know if it was Mark Ellis, Emma wasn't there, so it couldn't have been him, but somebody said, why would we ever...
That was a grade school.
They said, why would we ever do a favor for Phyllis Kahn? And Ron Aiden said, I think it's to the caucus's advantage to have her in France for as much of every summer before elections as we possibly could. Can't. for the Republic, they agreed to, and that got passed into law, and I never got to go to France again before an election, but that's, but I then also, you know, and it's not possible to do an election now, it's a little, an amendment now, it's a little too complicated, but again, one of the other experiences that I've had in elections, which was had again by one of our more recent caucus members, was having someone who didn't live in the district file against me. And there wasn't any problem. You didn't even really have to prove it, because the way he found out he didn't live in the district was when he got his election registration card, which showed him in a precinct living outside the district. And instead of, and he went and asked someone about it, and that's how we found out that he lived outside the district. But there was no way, in order to get him off the ballot, we then had to sue, which was, you know, we did, and we had the money, you know, we had the money to do it. But it seems when I went to the caucus, because I thought this was a caucus issue, to try and get them to pay for it, the caucus leadership at the time told me that it was just like Jim Rice had said about playing the lottery, that this guy's chance of winning was about, that Jim Rice said the chance of winning the lottery is about the same whether you buy a ticket or not. Jim Rice said this guy's chance of winning was about the same whether he was on the ballot or not. So they refused to pay and he did it. So we tried to try and do some legislation that makes it, and I think the Senate had it in a bill last year that went, and then it was taken out. Bill, is that true that they decided not to have it? Is that this issue of being able to? Did someone?
Representative Hilty.
Representative
Hilty.
Okay.
Do Representative
Hilty? Do you remember?
Con has asked you a question, Representative Hilty.
Do you remember if we had that thing about
Hilty?
Representative, I think Representative Hilty wishes to respond to your question.
Mr. Chair, my response is I do not know the answer to it.
Okay. Sorry.
I'm not
Sure
I even know what Representative
the question is. The question is,
Where are we, Mr. Chairman?
I will repeat the question.
Representative Emmer has another question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering where we are.
Okay.
Representative Emmer, I cannot answer that question either. Representative Khan.
Okay, the question specifically is that, and the answer is no one remembers, but we have had legislation introduced, to make it easier to throw someone off the ballot who is ineligible to run because they don't live in the district without having to go to court to do it. You might have to go to court to prove it, but where there's no need to prove it, to have to go to court to throw someone off the ballot because they don't reside in the district seems like a waste of court time and so forth. And so I'd like to do, you know, I don't have an amendment prepared. It seems to me it would fit into this bill because we're looking at those kinds of requirements. I'm sorry I don't have an amendment now to do it, but I would like to prepare an amendment to put that on this bill, on the floor. I can't see it being something that's objectionable, but...
Representative Khan, you then are preparing an amendment?
I think
with your status as the historian of policy.
Yes. And I told you how election law changes are made, Mr. Chairman.
I think we got lost somewhere in France in Bordeaux.
Okay. Representative
Khan,
it's a very good place to be lost between. I'll tell you. Much nicer than here.
Are there any other questions to the amended version of Senate File 1298? I don't think Representative Khan has an amendment.
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Maybe you've discussed this, but I'm like on page 4. I'm on line 4.267 and 28. Talks about the county auditor or municipal clerk shall provide first class postage for the return envelope. How is that going to work? The question is, how does it work mechanically? Can they use an indicia that they only have to pay for those that are mailed back so they're not paying for something that doesn't get mailed back? A. B. That is not done now, as I understand it. The voter provides their own stamps?
No, Mr. Representative Peterson, if you look at the language, the stricken language on 5.25 and 5.26, you'll see that this is a current requirement that the county auditor or municipal clerk provide the postage. The only difference between the language is that on 5.25 it says shall affix first class postage, and here itself says shall provide first class postage. Some local election administrators have taken the shall affix to mean that they have to put a stamp on the envelope, which is expensive if the person decides not to mail it. Yeah. So this would allow them the choice of doing mailing that's going to if it comes back.
All right. Is there any further discussion to Senate File 1298 as amended? Members, before I go to Representative Vimmer, I want to just discuss something else, because Representative Broad is here. It has been the preference of this committee to send election bills out as single vehicles. This has been a discussion that we have had with Senator Rest for the last year and almost a half. It has been the preference of leadership to have omnibus election bills, which have not fared well with the governor. It only takes one item in the bill to bring the entire bill down. The compromise this session, after several weeks of discussion, have been to do what you see before you, bundle, and that is to have smaller bills bundled together with the understanding that the governor would be receptive to these for signature. So if the question is why are we doing it this way, it's because we couldn't do single bills. The omnibus bills were being vetoed, and this apparently will be a way that these bills will become law. That's why we're doing it in this fashion. So with that, and I wanted to make sure that Representative Broad was here when I made that description. She had been gone for a period of time, and not just because of today with the snow, but that's what we're doing. So with that, Representative Emmer to the amended version of Senate File 1298. Or Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I appreciate the explanation. I'm just wondering then, is the plan for all the other election bills that they all ride separately through the process for all the other ones that are not brought forward today?
Representative Broad, if you're asking what my preference would be, yes. My preference would be to have the bills go out individually to the floor. Leadership's preference is not to bring them up individually. So if you're talking my preference, yes. Leadership, I think then you go to leadership and say, let's bring them up individually. And I think they would have a greater likelihood of being signed by the governor if they were brought up individually. But that is not where we are at this point. We're at this compromise. Representative Emmer, you had a question for the amended bill.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is probably from Ms. Frazier. Page 10, line 10.5, oath to obey the law. Could you tell me or explain to us a little more detail what that is about and why it's necessary to put it in here?
Ms. Frazier. Or do you want Mr. Gehring to Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, based upon a conversation I had with the governor's office yesterday, we had actually agreed to drop this section. So,
all right. Ms. Frazier, can you point to the section now? Or Mr. Gehring? Mr. Gehring, can you point to the section?
Mr. Chair, the section being referred to is section 14, which is on page 10 of the bill. Lines 10.3 to 10.8, and the section specifies that in order to act as a challenger in a polling place, the challenger has to provide an oath that they understand the laws that govern challengers and the laws governing how you challenge a voter.
All right, so Ms. Frazier, then this section should be deleted from the bill. Representative Hilty, you want to speak to that?
Sure, if that is the agreement, then apparently it would be appropriate to move to delete Section 14.
All right, Representative Hilty, do you want to make a motion then to delete Section 14?
As soon as I verify that is the agreement. Yes, Mr. Chair, I would make that motion then.
All right, Representative Hilty moves to delete on page 10, section 14, lines 10.3 to 10.8. That's the motion before us. Any discussion to that motion? Representative Emmer.
Why? Chairman, Ms. Frazier, why was there agreement to take this out? And I think the committee needs to know a little bit more. I mean, I appreciate the explanation as to what the brief explanation about the law, but my understanding that this is the issue where we're trying to verify that people can in fact vote in our elections, and I'm wondering why there was an agreement to take it out.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the original thinking behind this provision was that there had been problems with challengers in the 04 and 06 elections where some of the challengers didn't seem to understand the role that they were supposed to be playing, or the state laws around same-day registration. And so I think the rationale for including it originally was to ensure that challengers do understand their role and the laws. When I met with representatives from the governor's office yesterday, they raised some concerns about this provision. They felt that it was too heavy-handed and were concerned that if the challenger took an oath that they obeyed, that they understood the law and would obey it, but misunderstood the law, that there could potentially be a lawsuit. So since they raised concerns, we agreed to drop this provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, who specifically raised those concerns in the governor's office, and are they here today to tell us in their own words? And I'll tell you why I'm concerned. Because I've got your new application out of your office, and it looks like we are on a move, and I've got some more questions about this proposal. We're on a move to take away a verification, and I'll give you an example. I've got the form that you folks use, returned to the Secretary of State. I've got an original form from just a couple of months back that says to register to vote in the state of Minnesota, you must meet all three of the following qualifications. One, a citizen of the United States of America, and two, a resident of Minnesota at least 20 days before Election Day, and three, at least 18 years old by Election Day. And then it's got some instructions to the voter, and it's interesting, this same form now has been modified by your office to eliminate those explanations and requirements, and I'm concerned that we seem to have a move, and I'll give you another example. This new voter application, as you call it, the registration card, as it used to be called, has a new box marked number 7, and it gives these things that you get to verify who you are. You get to check one of these. One, I have a Minnesota-issued driver's license or Minnesota ID card number. Two, I do not have a Minnesota-issued driver's license or Minnesota ID card. The last 4 digits of my Social Security number are, and then the last one that you've added is, I do not have a Minnesota-issued driver's license, a Minnesota-issued ID card, or a Social Security number. I'm very concerned that there seems to be some movement, whether it's intentional or just we're asleep at the wheel, where we're moving away from verifying that people do, in fact, have a right to vote in our elections. That's why I'd be interested to know who it is in the governor's office that wants to remove this section, and I'm wondering if they're here to tell us in more detail why they think it's a problem.
All right, Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. The person who was in the meeting yesterday was Ms. Yanis, the legal counsel for the governor. This section, just to clarify, requires that a person serving as a challenger take an oath that they will abide by the law. Okay. I just wanted to be clear about that. The questions that you raised about the voter registration application are not related to this bill. And we have not changed the voter registration application. We're in the process of amending the rules to do so, but have not yet changed it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I won't belabor it.
To the motion, no.
Perhaps Ms. Frazier didn't understand me. I understand when you're going to challenge someone in a polling place, it's part of the verification process, in my humble opinion, which is why I'm relating what appears to be, and I understand you're in the process of the rulemaking process, which is interesting because that was done over the summer rather than coming to this process. It's nice that you've come back to this process, at least for some of this. again, I didn't mean to imply that what you're doing with your proposals on identifying voters is somehow in this bill. It was the, I'm very concerned that we're taking out, for instance, the oath for, it's part of the training, Ms. Fraser, and I would move to leave that. I'd make an argument, obviously, against the motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Well, right. Remember, the motion is the Hilty motion to delete Section 14. That's the motion that's before us. Any further discussion? Ms. Fraser, do you want to say? No. Any further discussion to the motion?
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I understand.
To the motion.
Yes, to the motion. I understand this is something that is the Secretary of State, Representative Hilty, put this in. And this is something that because the governor asked to have this taken out is why we're taking it out, is why the motion was made to take it out. Mr. Chairman, I don't do this often in committee, but I'd like a roll call vote on this motion to take it out.
Representative Kahn has requested a roll call. The clerk will then take the roll on the Hilty motion to remove Section 14 on page 10, lines 10.3 to 10.8. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Anderson? Representative Broad?
No.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Hilty?
Aye.
Representative Powers? Representative Kahn?
Aye.
Representative Kalin?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poppy?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Winford?
Aye.
Representative Wolfsmacher is absent.
There being 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. Section 14 is removed from the bill. All right. Any further discussion on Senate File 1298 as amended? Seeing no further discussion, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate File 1298 as amended? Then Representative Hilty renews his motion that Senate File 1298 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Members, Representative Simon, yes, he is here. Representative Simon, let's go to your bill quickly, and then Representative Huntley, we will take your bill up next after Representative Simon. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is House File 1546, and I you'd like me to make the motion.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1546 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that we had last year, only this time we've taken out the most contentious part. This originally was the automatic voter registration bill that had to do with what happens when you go and get your driver's license. Right now there's a box that you can check if you want to be registered to vote. This would reverse the presumption, but that's all gone now. So what's left in the bill is that if someone moves within Minnesota and files a permanent forwarding order with the Postal Service, the voter registration is automatically updated. The person will receive a postcard in the mail telling them of their new polling location. Likewise, if someone moves outside of Minnesota and files a permanent forwarding order, their voter registration will automatically be removed. So I think there's enough in here for most people to be satisfied. This is the portion on which there was widespread agreement. So no more driver's license stuff. This just has to do with the forwarding orders when someone moves. Secretary of State will get monthly updates. The bill will be effective upon certification that the statewide voter registration system has been tested. That's the bill, members. We already saw it, but it's leaner and meaner than it was last year.
So, Sam, let's just hope it's leaner. Any discussion to House File 1546? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Fraser, can you maybe just state for the committee the process that's been going forward alongside of the legislative process or in front of the legislative process with the Secretary of State and the committee that has been meeting along the way?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brody, you were going to have a state sanction. Okay. Under the Help America Vote Act, in order to use the federal funds that have been given to the state of Minnesota, originally the state had to put together a plan and had to have an advisory committee to help put together that plan. We this past summer reconvened a committee, and Representative Broad was one of the members, as is Representative Cosey, and discussed using the federal HAVA funds to make these changes. The committee met, and the proposed amendment to the HAVA plan has been submitted to the Election Assistance Commission. So we now have permission to use the HAVA funds to pay for the programming that would be required to make this change. Under current law, the Secretary of State is able to get updates of people's addresses from the Postal Service, but cannot update their record with their new address. And so this bill would change that so that we could update their record and send them a card.
Members, before we continue this, we have a delete all amendment, I believe, that Representative Simon was referring to. He's moved the bill, but we did not move the delete all amendment. So, Representative Simon, why don't you move the delete all amendment, which will put the bill in the shape you described, and then the bill will be in order. So, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the delete all amendment numbered
DE1?
DE1, yeah.
All right. Representative Simon moves DE1. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. And now, members, the bill is in the order that Representative Simon described it. Representative Broad, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chairman. Well, one of the concerns that was brought up at that meeting it was that the change of addresses are not necessarily a change of residency. And maybe you can explain to the committee how that actually works. And the concern is really that you're kicking people out of the system and then telling them that in order to not have their address changed, they then have to act. So the concern is that you're moving people out without a firm commitment from them that their residence has actually changed. It's just changed on a piece of paper. So maybe you can walk through the process from the Postal Service as to how that change actually occurs and whether a change in residence or a change in postal address is actually a change in residence, because that was something that was brought up in that committee.
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, under current law, if a county auditor receives a mailing back from a voter that indicates that they have filed a permanent forwarding order, they are allowed to inactivate that voter's record. So they would disappear from the roster and need to re-register in order to vote. Under current law, we are allowed to get the list from the Postal Service and similarly inactivate people's records who it's been indicated have moved. What this will do is provide a service to those voters so that they do not just disappear from the roll, but instead their address is updated, their registration, they're registered at their new address, and we send them a postcard to their new address saying, as a service to you, we've updated your address. Here is where your new polling place is. If you don't want to be registered here, this is not your new residence, please let us know. Otherwise, you're all set. Local election officials estimate that about 80% of same-day registrants have just moved from one location to another in Minnesota, and so this should substantially cut down on the number of people needing to register, the length of the lines at the polling place, as well as the amount of work that goes into hand-entering voter registration cards.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Simon, this is absolutely a step in the right direction. I want to thank you for your work on this. The bill that you brought forward last year was extremely concerning to many of us, and this hopefully will move in the direction. I have a few concerns over the language, but it moves in the right direction of cleaning up the rules, so thank you very much.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now, after all that happiness, I have a concern. Ms. Fraser, I'm looking at page 2, and I just highlighted the information that says, at least once each month, the Secretary of State shall obtain a list of individuals in the state who have filed with the United States Postal Service a change of their permanent address. I am very concerned in light of, obviously, and I raised these concerns last summer, in light of your office's use of lists. I'd like to know what protections are in place so that the Secretary of State is actually going to keep this information, the list of individuals, secure, and we don't have a situation where the Ritchie campaign suddenly gets this monthly list of individuals under the same circumstances that we had last summer. Is there some protection that's been put in place to protect that, I don't know that it's lending of information, but the taking of that information for campaign purposes within your office?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, this list would be obtained electronically, and the records in the statewide voter registration system that, so people who have moved, who are registered, their records would be flagged, and it would just happen electronically. We would not physically have a list of people that have filed these orders, and any campaign can purchase the voter rolls, and that would be the process that would have to be used for any candidate or a party or other group that's going to use the list for political purposes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Ms. Fraser. Well, regardless of whether it's electronic or not, what I was asking for are the protections, because in fact, the Ritchie campaign did not pay anything for the other list information that it took that was not supplied in connection with a campaign-related activity. I am concerned here. You can have folks in your office who are taking the information simultaneously. I'm asking not just whether there's a system in place to pay for the information, the voter rolls, but could you tell us what protections have been put in place to ensure that this information that's being collected on a monthly basis is just not simultaneously then provided to the Ritchie campaign?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the data in question last fall was all public data. This is not public data. And there are processes in place to be sure that it is only released to those who have purchased the list and signed the statement saying that they will use it for political purposes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, it's those processes that I'm asking you about. We can get into a disagreement outside of this committee hearing about your definition of the data last fall, and we do have a disagreement. I'm asking specifically about those processes or processes that are in place. I want to know what protections are what applied within the office so that we have some comfort and security in knowing that as the Secretary of State's office reviews this information monthly, that it isn't automatically then transferred to the Ritchie campaign. That's what I'm asking.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I would need to have another staff person from the office talk about the processes. I don't have that information.
I think Representative Emmer, to be fair to this bill, let's put that off until we have those individuals here. We didn't know we were going to get into that discussion today, and there will be other opportunities.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I've been put off before.
Well, Representative Emmer, it's been a slow start with the weather, so let's try to expedite what we can. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this sounds like a good provision, but I've got a couple of questions because it's come up with me with a couple of friends that have given to my campaigns, and when I've sent them stuff back, the post offices, in one case they changed the zip code and where he lives, and so the mail comes back to me. And just one that happened this year was when I sent the receipt out off the address that was on the check and the address that I'd given sent to this gentleman before, They changed the name of his road, and they changed his zip code, and they changed his mailing, the city that it's got to go to, and they returned it to me for that reason. Would a situation like that cause this to get jumped out of the system and this person's voter status put on inactive? Or
Ms. Frazier.
Or is it something else? I'm bringing something else you haven't come across before.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. In that situation, the person would not be made inactive. Their address would be updated in the system, and they would stay registered under this current, under the proposal. Under current law, I don't think that they would be made inactive if their zip code changed, but I would need to have a local person in some more details about that.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I was merely going to respond to Representative Emmer, but you've requested that discussion take place at another time.
Thank you. I do want to deal with the Huntley bill, but that bill can proceed. So, any further discussion to House File 1546's amendment? Anyone else wish to testify for or against? All right. All those in favor of Representative Simon's motion to pass House File 1546 as amended to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Hunter. Representative Huntley, your bill is before us. I'm going to move that House File 3391 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice. And I believe your bill is before us because of its rulemaking. So if we could confine our comments today to the rulemaking portions of the bill. And Representative Huntley, if you would point out those rulemaking portions for us, please.
Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Doesn't it also establish the commission?
It also establishes the commission. Representative Kahn, so we've got two entities that are in the Representative Huntley. And Representative Kahn, just as a reminder, then, if we could confine our comments to those two portions.
I just would Representative expect Huntley. That you would forgotten.
Thank you. I, Representative Kahn,
members,
I haven't.
This is the health care reform bill. It grew out of both the governor's health care transformation task force and the health care, and the other group was the health care access commission. Most of the things in this bill are acceptable to the governor at this time from because most of it is from his task force. And there is an amendment that is technical but needs to be adopted before we get into the discussion.
Representative Huntley, if someone would, Representative Nelson moves the A18 amendment. Representative Huntley, would you just explain what the amendment says?
It just clarifies some of the language that relates to these commissions and their duties.
Any discussion to the A18 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Huntley, I think what I'll do at this point is have Mr. Shepherd go over those portions of the bill that do go over commissions and rulemaking, and then if you want to respond after Mr. Shepherd. So, Mr. Shepherd, would you go over those sections, please? And members, I believe there is a memo from Mr. Shepherd in your packet, and he'll be using that memo. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members, at the very bottom of your packet, I think there's a memo in which I pointed out the sections of this bill that deal with government structure and rulemaking. And I'll go over it very quickly. Representative Huntley can answer questions. And on page 6 requires the Commissioners of Health and Human Services to establish a care coordination advisory committee. And the bill notes that this may be done by continuing an existing committee. On page 21 of the bill, there is a uniform outcome measures working group established. On page 32 of the bill establishes the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, and the Board of Directors is established on page 36. Page 39 and continuing on to page 40 establishes a Healthcare Transformation Commission. and page 42 requires that commission to appoint an advisory committee to make some recommendations on inclusion of new and existing health technologies to the standard benefit set. The next page, 43, requires the same commission to convene an advisory committee to make recommendations on a standard benefit set and design. And the last page of the bill, section 51, assigns duties to a risk-sharing advisory council. On the rulemaking issues, the amendment that you just adopted changes pages 5 and 6 to require certain certification standards and other criteria to be reported to the legislature, but states that these aren't rules. There's a similar change on page 7, the author's amendment, provided that determinations of what data must be collected have to be reported to the legislature, but that this determination of data collection is not a rule. Page 41 of the bill authorizes the Healthcare Transformation Commission, which I mentioned a minute ago, to adopt rules. Under the author's amendment, these rules would be adopted under the Administrative Procedure Act in the normal rulemaking process. And finally, Mr. Chair, page 48 of the bill requires the Healthcare Transformation Commission to develop a payment system linking the level of provider payments to quality and efficiency of care, and the author's amendment that you just adopted requires this to be done through rulemaking.
All right, members, we have one individual who traveled some distance to testify on the bill, and anyone who's traveled any distance today deserves at least to come up. So I have a Glenn, is it Gruenhagen? Is it? All right, and if you could confine your comments to those portions of the bill that are before the committee, welcome to the committee, and thank you for traveling a distance today. So if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Glenn Gruenhagen. I'm from Glenville, Minnesota. I've sold health insurance in the state for over 30 years. And so my concern is, as far as the bill, and I'll try and confine it, my comments, to the areas of the health insurance exchange rulemaking and the commission. I oppose all three. I believe that it's another step in the wrong direction that will result in less medical care and higher costs for the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and will eventually lead to rationing and a government-run health system which will be expensive and inefficient. The health insurance exchange sets up powers and empowers another expensive government bureaucracy, for the most part unaccountable to the people and to the detriment of the overwhelming majority of Minnesota citizens. More government control of health care and health insurance choices will equal higher costs and less medical care, further eroding the doctor-patient relationship. Government regulations and excessive paperwork, which, for example, Minnesota Care is already strangling the health care industry. The least that should be done before any bill is passed is to have experts in health care assess government's impact on cost, access, and treatment in the health care industry. I'll be the first to admit that the current situation in health care and the rising health insurance premiums is unacceptable and needs reform. I'm also sit on a public school board for the last 13 years. The question is, so I see the negative impact of high health insurance premiums. The question is, which way do we go in order to improve the doctor-patient relationship? More government or open market competition? I believe the facts support open market competition will produce a lower cost and a better quality of health care for the citizens of Minnesota. So what should be done? I believe the following actions would reduce health care costs and improve the doctor-patient relationship, resulting in better medical care for our citizens. Number one, open up the state to out-state health insurance competition. Also, make health insurance affordable. Number two, repeal as many mandates as possible. Three, guaranteed issue will drive up the cost of health care for the majority of Minnesota citizens. Don't penalize the majority to improve the situation of the minority. And I'll leave it at that. Number three, develop a legislative plan 3 to 5 years to get state government out of paying for the health care services. The government should be a referee and not a payer of health care services. Number four, empower people below the poverty line to purchase private health insurance. Number five, litigation reform. And I'll let Tom Emmer speak to that. And number six, and this is my final comment. I left a packet with Mark, I believe.
Yes.
And I just like that passed out. The other thing is I'm writing a short booklet on health care reform with a medical device engineer from St. Jude Medical right here in the state. And he also is strongly concerned about government's effect on the health care industry and also new technology. The last comment I would make is this. In October 07, the Minneapolis Star Tribune published an article where 3M executives indicated that they're going to start considering moving operations out of the state of Minnesota because they can save almost $1 billion in operational costs. So when I read things like that, and also being a private businessman, when you keep increasing the percentage of Minnesota's GNP that the government takes, you make it more and more difficult for the private sector to offer jobs, offer health insurance benefits, and offer, and compete in a global economy. So the last thing I'd say is the way for government to increase revenues and provide the services it wants to is to promote a philosophy that expands the private sector. As the private sector grows and develops more jobs, you will generate more revenue. But to constantly take a higher percentage only hurts Minnesota families and businesses and ultimately the children in the state of Minnesota and your children and grandchildren. Hey, thank you for the opportunity of having a chance to share with you, and I'm open to any questions you have.
Members, we do have the packet that was passed out, and I might draw your attention to page A. And I believe Representative Emmer is a member of this group and a dynamic member, it says here, too. Representative Emmer, your picture there. Any questions? Representative Brock.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to thank Mr. Gruenhagen for being here. He has been a very active person around the healthcare industry and insurance industry, and is a great voice of interest and influence on issues related to healthcare. So I just want to thank him for taking the time to be here and trails through the snow. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much.
Should I make one last comment? I've got almost 1,000 clientele or customers in my policy holders or whatever you want to call them, in my little agency. Okay, I started it from scratch, all right, 30 years ago. And the way health insurance premiums have gone, I've had people crying at the table, all right, because they can't afford the health insurance that they want for their families. So I know how important this issue is to people, businesses, and, the people of the state of Minnesota. I see it every day. You've got to assess government's impact on driving those costs up and on limiting competition in the state. That is having a very adverse effect for the average consumer of health insurance in the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hunt, members were, if for anyone who was here on House File 3172, that will be held over until our next meeting. So, Representative Huntley, any discussion to House File 3391? Mr. Griffin, you had said you wanted to testify, and if you could make it brief and hopefully to those parts of the bill that I'm going to
please.
Yep. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing the eight plans that are members of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, insuring more than 4 million people. The portions of the bill that I want to address today that are before you are the ones that Mr. Shepard outlined on page 32 and page 39, the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange and the creation of the Health Care Transformation Commission. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, members, as you know, this is a very difficult problem. We are grateful to Representative Huntley for the work that he's done. But we do want to point out to committee members that you are creating two new government agencies. We're asking you to very carefully consider when you create these whether or not the money that's being spent on these might not be better spent on health care services and the direct delivery of care. And the reason we give you that caution is that these things are funded two different mechanisms, excuse my voice this morning. The first one of the health insurance exchange is by adding on a small tack on to the premium to cover the cost of the health insurance exchange. The other one, the healthcare transformation task force, is a blank appropriation in this bill, but has raised our concern because it has a $20 million appropriation over on the Senate side. That is a huge creation of a very massive agency, and we know that that's not Representative Huntley's intention, but we do want you to be aware of those. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Griffin, thanks for being here. Could you talk a little bit more about that, quote, tack-on?
Mr. Chairman, we don't know the details of how that's going to work. As we've discussed it with the health department, who's been instrumental in trying to create this, this comes out of part of the work that the Transformation Task Force did this summer, and that was a study that was conducted by Mathematica. That study has not yet been released. We are hoping to see it this week, but the estimate is that it will be about a 0.5% addition to the health care premium to try and fund the exchange, which we think is a good idea. It's an arena in which we would have posted on the internet all of the policies that are in the digital market in the state. The question is just, where does the funding come from? And if there's a concern about increased costs in health care, this is an increased cost. If we came to you and said, as health plans, we need to raise administrative expenses another 0.5%, we think that there might be concerns raised.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm trying to, when you say 0.5%, essentially you're talking about a premium tax. Is that fair enough?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we would call that, yes.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I think the point that I think Mr. Griffin suggested, but I think it's worth reiterating, is that if they came forward with 0.5% for administrative purposes, I think a lot of eyebrows would be raised, and the suggestion and the logic behind raising the cost of health care to lower the cost of health care is a bit curious.
Well, Representative Broad, yes, and but the point before us really are the issues that Mr. Shepard has raised. I share your concern. I would only hope that we would get the targets to all of our divisions as a result of the fiscal forecast that was released last week, and that might resolve a lot of issues with how much things cost. But Representative Winkler, did you? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm just wondering if you can speak to the exemptions in the rulemaking process and what the rationale for that would be. I think it was on page 32, but also I think in Article 1, pages 5 and 6, I'm just referring to Mr. Shepard's memo here. Certification and standing for the healthcare home are not rules that must be reported to the legislature. And similarly, the rulemaking process Section 14, or just going to page 32 here.
Let me answer that.
They're
already doing this. They're already contracting with the health plans to set up the system for medical homes. And this is simply allows them to complete those contracts.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, and the exemption from rulemaking for the Healthcare Transformation Commission.
Representative Huntley. All right, Representative Huntley,
yeah, we
let
took
Mr.
that
Shepard
out.
Yes, that has been removed from the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, I thought if we're going to move this advancing socialized medicine proposal forward, I'm surprised that Representative Kahn hasn't already requested a roll call, but I'll do that now.
Representative Emmer has requested a roll call, and Representative Kahn, do you wish to second it? Or
no.
Representative Kahn.
said I rarely requested roll call for the committee. It's only when something very strange happens that I ask for one.
Representative Tom, you may, of course, need to tell the story of Representative Trimble and his description of you as a historian of the House, but we're running out of time.
Representative Trimble, I forgot him. He's better, much better person to me. But I would just like Representative Huntley, and I've been trying to read through all of these, to tell us exactly how many commissions are being, and how many working groups are being established in this, and how many are just transformations of other ones, and how many are new ones, and how we decide. Some of them have some weird things that they expire unless they decide on their own that they shouldn't expire, and some of them have the Risk-Sharing Advisory Council doesn't seem to have any expiration date, and I don't know if that's necessary or not. And there's another one where, on page 41, and the last thing I asked that was deleted was that commission can contract with other organizations to carry out all or part of its responsibilities. And I don't know if that's a new power that we give to commissions and what the power, who oversees those contracts and what.
Representative Huntley.
On the latter point, I think that relates to two organizations that already exist. The Institute for Clinical Science Improvement, which is already setting sort of standards of how chronic diseases should be treated, and the other is the, I believe, the Community Measurement Organization, which evaluates how various clinics are performing in terms of the measurements that it sets up. So those are really already out there.
I believe Representative Tom is asking for a page number, if that's possible. Representative Tom.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the last one I asked about was the one about contracting with other organizations. That refers to the last one.
Yeah. And, well, there's the health, Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange is being set up. That was, the governor had that bill last year. It was not passed. It is in this bill. That's will set up this exchange where people can buy health insurance policies, and that is voluntary. So if you don't want to buy your insurance through that, you don't have to. They also answer to the Healthcare Transformation Commission, which is sort of the overarching group to change the system. And I must say that Tom Forsythe, who was the immediate past chairman of the Chamber of Commerce, was very active in these groups, supports these kinds of things. So, and I would also say that most of the thrust of this organization is being endorsed by companies like General Mills. Nationally, they're also doing this. Most of the major corporations are supporting at least the direction that we're trying to go here. But I don't know the
time.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I got an answer to my question, so let me repeat it.
Okay.
Which is, the repeating of the question is, how many commissions, working groups, and so forth are established? How many are new ones, and how many are just continuities? And why do we have different rules for some of them? And I guess I couldn't, when you were describing, like, for example, the contract with other organizations. When I asked about that, you named two groups that I couldn't find in the language above it. So I'm just...
Well, first of all, there's the Health Insurance Exchange. That is one group. There's the Healthcare Transformation Commission, which is the group that will try to transform the healthcare system. There's a Healthcare Value Reporting Organization. And where are my notes then? Okay, I've been told there are eight groups, and one of these are already in existence, and those contracts relate to existing organizations.
Mr. Chairman, is it also the intention then to have either joint legislative commissions that will follow each one of these commissions, or separate subcommittees in the House and Senate to follow each one of these?
In the case of the Risk-Sharing Advisory Council, that report to the Healthcare Access Commission, and there was what they do is if we decide to get rid of MSHA, then you have to do something about costs of very sick people, and so that's what that committee is going to do. Could you repeat your question there,
Representative Tom?
Well, the last question I asked was, are we going to expect to have either joint legislative commissions following each one of these, or separate commissions from the House and Senate health committees following each one of these? I'm trying to get a roadmap as to how we're going to learn about health care.
Most of these groups, the commissioners of Health, Human Services, and Commerce, as it relates to insurance, are part of those groups, so there's oversight there. And in addition, for a lot of these groups, the legislature will appoint members to those commissions.
Members, we have another committee that's waiting in the hall to come in. We're 10 minutes over our time. Any further discussion to House File 3391 as amended? Then I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3391 as amended be re-referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice. The roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Representative Braun?
No.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Tilkey?
Aye.
Representative Hollis? Representative Kahn?
Aye.
Representative Thielen? Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Poppy?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Representative Simon.
Representative Simon.
I vote. There being 9 ayes and 3 nays, motion prevails. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes to Wednesday, February 27th.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.